I'm Nick Archer. I'm the British ambassador in Prague, where I've lived and worked for 3.5 years. And this year, 2021, my top diplomatic priority is helping make a success of COP26 in Glasgow in November.
Before we get to the Conference of Parties, which is the main topic I would like to talk to you about, I would like to ask a more broader question probably. And it is, because by many measures, UK is a world leader in taking climate action. And I would like to ask you, how is it possible to achieve such strong public and political commitment to that cause?
The critical thing is that there has to be a message that resonates with each part of society. And one of the extraordinary things in Britain is that this is not a right-left issue. And the reason for that, I think, is that unusually, the Conservative Party, right of centre, were very early to understand the threat posed by climate change. Mrs. Thatcher was a scientist by training and had one or two scientists in her senior team and was persuaded that there was a threat. And for her, the answer to that was a very conservative answer, which was about looking after your possessions, being careful, saving money. By turning the lights off, I think was what she said. So on the left, I think traditionally it's always been rather easier. And we suddenly found ourselves with a very broad political consensus. It's not universal, obviously, but there's a very broad consensus. The second thing I would say, and I'm very keen that none of these things should sound unique to Britain, because after all, we want to see the same thing across the world. But the second thing is that we have a very strong tradition in Britain of natural history television. And it is hugely popular. And so people like Sir David Attenborough are people to whom Britons will listen and whom they'll believe. They have huge credibility. Now, those television programs didn't used to be about the environment. They were much more about the animals. But over recent years, the focus has shifted, as we've seen, for example, the habitats of, I don't know, polar bears being very directly threatened. And so there's a very soft message, very apolitical message that people are getting at the same time about how these things that they value and have grown to love are at real risk.
So first reason is security, national security. And the second is that people naturally care about environment because you have the tradition there.
National security, certainly. But I don't think the population sees it like that. I mean, there are people who buy the Thatcher message that it's profligate, it's wasteful to leave the lights on when you leave the room. I mean, it really is that simple. And that you can run your house more cheaply if you make sure that the windows are closed when it's cold outside. So there's all that going on. But the other thing I would say is that very often across Europe, certainly, the discussion implies that it's the young who are pressuring the old to become more aware of this issue. And in Britain, it's not like that. I mean, it's my generation. Those of us who've been getting used to this message and looking at the deterioration of the global environment for 20 years, who are equally concerned and who have over that period of decades got very used to recycling, to doing all the little things. And that would take me to the last point, which is we did legislate way back in the 80s. At that time, we were legislating for an 80% reduction in emissions by 2050. Very early on, I think the first country to do that. But we also used what psychologists call nudge theory to move the population. And what that's about, a nudge is a little, it's where you touch somebody quite lightly on the elbow and say, oh, look over there or whatever. And nudge theory is about incentivizing people not by making anything dramatically illegal or hugely rewarded, but about encouraging people to do little things with little rewards. So you might get a slight discount on electricity from a certain source. You know, you might have to pay a very small amount of money for a plastic bag. and you add up lots of these small measures, and first of all, you save energy, but second, you create a population that's much more aware.
So when the big changes come, your population is kind of already prepared or used to doing something. So when they have to do a little more, it's not a problem then.
Yeah, I mean, when we saw tornadoes in Moravia and floods in Germany this summer and villages going up in flames in Spain, those were very dramatic phenomena, obviously. But I think there was a sense in Britain that we had for some time been trying to do our bit to, you know, to mitigate that problem, to reduce it in scale. So, and people find, we all find it easier to acquire new habits gradually than being told overnight you've got completely to change your life. So I'm not sure it's as dramatic as national security or fundamental change. I think it's more about just over time accustoming people. The problem now for populations who haven't been on that journey is that we're running out of time, and that's really what the Glasgow COP is all about.
If we can get to the Glasgow COP, UK is the host of this year's Conference of Parties. What are the hosting party responsibilities, and how do you plan to achieve those?
It's the responsibility of the COP, of course, is shared between the host country and the United Nations. And I have personal experience of this because I was ambassador in Copenhagen at the time of COP15, which was intended to be transformatory. And the responsibilities are very intertwined. So it's very difficult to say, you know, host country does this, United Nations does that. But I think it is fair to say that the creation of the right atmosphere for deals to be done is very much the responsibility of the host country. And it's fair also to say that you know, 90% of that is done before the Conference of the Parties starts. And that's why, you know, for well over a year, I and all my colleagues everywhere in the world have been campaigning very hard to bring countries to the point at which, when their leaders meet in Glasgow, they're prepared to make the very big commitments necessary. And those commitments are obviously not new, but about actually deciding how we're going to do what we said we would do in Paris at the last big COP.
And could you be please more specific? I mean, what exactly are you doing to create the environment, to motivate the leaders to be able to achieve those goals?
Well, all kinds of things. So we have ministers. We have one minister who's going to be the chairman, who's full-time on this, and we have others, you know, our foreign secretary, our prime minister. They all are wanting to talk about this with their counterparts, so we facilitate those contacts. What we've found over the years and what we saw before the Copenhagen conference is that to make a commitment to a reduction of emissions, for example, a government has to understand what technologies are available. So we are doing a huge amount of work to share awareness, knowledge of emerging technologies. You know, hydrogen is in the news in the Czech Republic as we speak. And there are energy-saving technologies because, of course, you know, there are some countries in which it's more difficult to generate energy from renewables, but it is always possible to create more eco-friendly houses that use less power and to buy an electric car rather than a petrol one. And so there's a huge amount of work to be done sharing knowledge of the enabling technologies. Then there's the whole business of targets. And again, I know that's quite controversial in the Czech Republic, where there's a tendency to say that a target has to seem realistic today. What we're telling people is that the pace of technological change is now so fast that you could say you would do something impossible today, but in 5 or 10 years' time, it will seem perfectly achievable. And therefore, we can all commit ourselves, as Great Britain did back in the 1980s, to a target that seems unattainable, confident in the knowledge that we will get there because the world will change and the technology will change. So it's a mixture of these political messages As I say, sharing technology. But then the third element, of course, is persuading people that this is serious. There's also a sense in many countries that it's not our problem, because European countries are not amongst the really big emitters these days. There's a sense that it's unfair if we take a hit whilst the big emitters are evading their responsibilities. So we have to address those points and make it very, very clear that leading by example does work in this area, that the big emitters have their own environmental problems, which most of them are seeking to address, not least China. And that in any case, you know, why wouldn't you want cleaner air, cleaner water, and houses and cars that are cheaper to run? We already know that if you're a business and you run a fleet of cars, it's cheaper to run a fleet of electric cars because there's less to go wrong. Now, we're reaching the tipping point for the private consumer. But in the end, my message, our message, is consistently that to see this as a threat is completely wrong. To see it as both a commercial and a quality of life opportunity is just logical.
Thank you. I would like to ask you to talk a little bit about what is the UK's position in this year's Conference of Parties. And I mean, what are some results that you would like to see coming out of the conference, and at the same time, results that are realistic or achievable or negotiable, probably?
Well, the bottom line is that every country needs to be able to explain how it's going to deliver on its Paris commitments. And indeed, we're looking for national targets that take us beyond those Paris commitments, because obviously the situation is more urgent now than it was then, because people didn't do what they said they'd do. So that's for everybody. But there's also a really pressing need for finance, because there are many countries that can't afford either the mitigation, that's to say dealing with the impacts of climate change, or the adaption, which is getting over to the low-carbon economy, that we need them to put in place. So we are looking for billions of pounds from richer developed countries, to enable the entire world to go low carbon. We're also looking for the kind of commitments that, you know, are coming through now. For example, to stop financing the development of new coal mines in other countries. Chinese have now made that commitment. Lots of other countries that used to do that have said they will stop. So commitments of a variety of kinds, which have to be credible and which the UN process will try to hold them to. And finance is critical, absolutely critical, because you can't expect poor countries to be able to afford what they have to do. And without paying proper attention to what's called climate justice, we're going to fail.
Again, I would like to ask you, could you be more specific? For example, in the finance spectrum,
yeah.
What would you like the result or the agreement to be from the conference? I mean, is it that everybody should write a check right now for some amount, or would you like to see new policies coming out of the conference? Or is it a motivation for the private sector to pay more? Or what is it?
Climate finance is for the states. And, Copenhagen, lots of states said that they would provide money. And then afterwards, that money just never materialized. So, yeah, I guess the crude answer to your question is the optimal scenario would be that people wrote very large checks. But of course, they won't. What we need is for people to make the kind of commitments that stand up to the scrutiny of their peers. So, you know, if Britain says we are going to put however many billion pounds into funds, UN-administered funds for climate adaptation and mitigation, then we say that knowing that our friends, that the international community will hold us to account and shout if we don't do that. So it doesn't have to be a check being signed in ink, but clearly if the sum total of the commitments is either not credible because we don't believe the countries, or alternatively, of course, not credible because it's not enough money to do the job, then we've got a big problem.
Some could say that in this area, some countries, I could say the developing countries, are losing faith to the more developed countries, because the commitment to pay $100 billion was up to 2020, I think, and now it's postponed. So
yeah.
We, as developed countries, we didn't do it. What would you suggest that we should do, or how should we approach this topic to give them back the faith, that the thing that they could trust us, that we can achieve that?
Well, the thing that will give them back the faith is the money coming through. And we have to go beyond the 100 billion, and we're not there yet. Although, as I say, one consequence of British diplomacy over the last months has been that countries are making those commitments, and they sound more serious than they did last time round. And one of the reasons for that is that we are now seeing the consequences of unbridled global warming. The challenge is that every government is finding money for all kinds of other important things, and there's still a strong sense that we have to shake that addressing global warming can wait until tomorrow. And we see that in European countries.
You've talked a little bit about what is your role as an embassy in this whole process.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit more about this? Because from my point of view, the conference is happening in the UK.
Yes.
Your embassy is in Prague. Mm. So what is the role of embassies in the whole world, and what are your responsibilities towards the conference?
Well, this is the British government's top priority, including top diplomatic priority for this year. That's clear. Other things happen, but the thing we devote our energy and our attention to, because we've chosen to, rather than been forced to, is preparing for a COP that will do those things that we need it to do. Secure the money, secure the commitments, provide a supportive environment in which leaders can be brave. Okay, so in every British embassy around the world, we're working towards that end. But in different British embassies around the world, it'll be very different. Partly because of our historic connections with countries all around the world through the Commonwealth, for example, we are working very deliberately with vulnerable small island states to ensure that their voices are heard. Because normally at big international gatherings, people perhaps don't pay a lot of attention to Nauru or Tuvalu. But these are the countries that are going to disappear under the water. And so we believe that the world has a moral obligation to listen to them and take them seriously. In a country like the Czech Republic, which is still very dependent on coal as a source of energy, it's not enough to say, stop using coal. That's not going to impress anybody. But what we can say is, this is how other countries have successfully stopped using coal. And this is how those other countries have sustained and indeed caused the economies of coal regions to prosper once they've given up coal. You know, this is how new industries can be brought in. This is how coal miners, perhaps in particular, can be retrained. And as I say, constantly emphasizing the economic opportunity and the fact that to be brave is not to be rash because of that changing technology point. We also want countries like the Czech Republic not only just to commit to moving out of coal pretty early, but to join us in encouraging other countries which are more reluctant to commit to moving out of coal. There's a debate which continues in the Czech Republic about whether it's sensible to set a date and what that date should be. We say, first of all, it is sensible to set a date because in every area of human life, if you set yourself a target, you're more likely to achieve it. And second, both because of technological change, but also because of economic pressures, you'll find that an early date becomes possible. So, for example, CES know, that it's already more expensive to generate a kilowatt of power from coal than from waste. It's only going to move in one direction. It's going to become easier and easier. So we say, knowing that, why don't you challenge yourselves to move out of coal by 2030? Now, if it doesn't happen, then there's no downside. But if it does happen, there's a massive upside. Just because Germany says 2038, is that a reason for the Czech Republic to say 2038? I don't think so.
So you would like us to be more brave and give ourselves a bigger challenges?
What we see time after time after time when it comes to climate change is that bravery is not rashness. That's to say, bravery is not foolish. Bravery delivers first mover advantage in terms of transforming your industry. And bravery delivers national pride, and bravery delivers benefits to your citizens more quickly.
Thank you very much for your time.
Good. Well, thank you very much.